Today I'm going to talk about cold dark matter, but first I just wanted to ask if anyone had a question before we got started. I have a question for you guys. How are you finding the length of the tutorials? Are they too long or too short or about right for the tutorial format?
What about this one?
Yeah. Okay. Can be hard to tell when writing them. Okay. So I'm going to talk about cold dark matter. I think a good place to start is by, so far I've talked about the cosmic neutrino background, which is part of the cosmological dark sector, but not the cold dark matter. So I think a good place to start is by writing down the observational constraint. One thing that's a bit unfortunate is that And then what's a bit unfortunate is that when I write down observational constraints, they tend to come out of nowhere. It's a bit difficult in a short course to really do justice to exactly how an observation like the CMB places all these constraints on so many things. But I'll try to explain it at hand-waving level. So one thing that does seem to be required by the observations are two components, a hot dark sector, a hot component, which shows up very strongly in the CMB, meaning where I'm defining hot to mean relativistic at temperatures in the rough range 0.3 eV to 10 eV. These are roughly the range of temperatures that are relevant for the formation of the CMB. So the cosmic neutrinos would be in this sector. They show up very strongly in the CMB. They are a large contribution to the stress energy at these early times. And if you were to take them out, you would really get the wrong CMB power spectrum. As a general rule, anything that affects the physics of the plasma at these sorts of temperatures, you can expect to be constrained at sort of a few percent level from the cosmic microwave background. And then secondly, a cold component, which is non-relativistic, even at temperatures like as high as a keV. And I'll talk about the observational constraints on these two sectors separately. So the hot component there's basically two constraints. One is that at early times, one is the CMB constraint, which says that at early times, roughly temperatures above 0.3 eV are scale factor less than 10 to the minus 3. There's a pretty sort of a few percent constraint on the energy density of the hot relativistic component. It's usually parameterized in kind of an odd way, which I'll write down. So this equation defines a parameter N effective. CMB in this equation is the temperature of the CMB today. Okay, so this definition wouldn't have been very well motivated a few lectures ago, But what I've done here is written down the energy density that you would get with an effective species of neutrinos, assuming that the neutrino decouples before electron-positron annihilation and after, well before electron-positron annihilation and well after muon annihilation. So we derived the pi squared over 30, and then this is the G star of one neutrino species. There's two spins with a factor of 7/8 because the neutrino is a fermion. So this is just the definition of the parameter N effective. And then the CMB constraint on N effective is 2.99, you know, from the CMB. So I'm introducing this notation because this is the way you'll see it written in all of the papers. When I discussed this constraint before, I parameterized it in a different way by instead of fixing the neutrino temperature and letting N effective be the parameter, I fixed N effective to 3 and let the neutrino temperature be a parameter. That's what gave the constraint 1.95 Kelvin plus or minus 0.03. It's the same constraint, but this is the way you'll usually see it. And then there's the late time constraint. So today, the energy density is in the hot component is small, like 0.03. This comes from a variety of probes that probe gravitational structure, the amount of gravitational structure which is formed in the universe. For example, the amount of gravitational lensing turns out to be pretty sensitive to the abundance in the late universe of hot dark matter. These constraints are satisfied. Both constraints are satisfied. By the standard model neutrinos, the three species of standard model neutrinos. If the sum of the neutrino masses is less than around 0.12 eV, that's coming from the late universe constraint, given your result from homework one, that the energy density of neutrinos is the sum of the neutrino masses over this magic number of 46 eV. One little detail that it's not very important with the current error bar, but it will be eventually important when the error bar shrinks. So I didn't mention it before, but it turns out that the standard model actually predicts just want to mention this briefly because you'll see it in papers. With this definition of N effective, the standard model actually predicts N effective is not quite 3, but a number about 1% larger than 3, 3.0146, not N effective equals 3. The reason for that is because it's a good but not perfect approximation that neutrino freeze-out is complete by the time of electron-positron annihilation. They actually overlap by about 1%. And that raises the energy density of the universe relative to, or of the hot component, raises the energy density or the temperature relative to the 4/11 to the 1/3 times TCMB. So it raises the value of n effective. If I define n effective this way, it raises it a little bit above 3. So it's kind of important to interpret this measurement of n effective, not really as anything neutrino specific, but just a constraint on the total energy density of dark relativistic species in the early universe. So if there's another light relic, other so here's a result which is non-trivial to derive, but we have all the machinery. I could have assigned this as a homework problem, but I decided not to. By an analysis similar to our analysis of the cosmic neutrino background, if I have other light relics, they make a contribution like this. It's a bit of a tangent, so I won't go through the derivation. Where there are we call this G star relic. So there are two G stars appearing in the equation. There's the G star of the relic particle, which is the same as the number of spin degrees of freedom if the particle is a boson, and 7/8 times the number of spin degrees of freedom if the particle is a fermion. And then there's G star deck, which is the the G star of the plasma. That decoupling. Yeah, just for completeness, there's a few assumptions here. One assumption is that the freeze-out temperature is larger than in MeV when the neutrinos decouple. And the other assumption is that the mass of the particle is much less than the freeze-out temperature, so that it's still relativistic at freeze-out. In the Bellman notes, there's a plot of this quantity G star deck. Sort of looks like this. I won't try to reproduce all the features, but there's some features when species annihilate. There's a feature, and so this is G star versus time. The way that you compute this is you just sort of sum over particles in the standard model. And as the universe expands and cools, you just sum up the species that are still relativistic, still above the temperature of the plasma. So there's a feature at around 0.5 MeV where the electrons and positrons annihilate, another feature around 100 MeV, and then another feature around 100 GeV. The energy scale of the electroweak phase transition. So depending on where in this history, if there are particles beyond the standard model that freeze out and become light relics, their contribution to n effective really depends on at what point in the history they decouple. One magic number that is worked out in the Bauman notes is that the limiting value here in the standard model turns out to be 106.75. That's what you get if you just sum up all of the species in the standard model, weighted by the number of spin states with a factor of 7/8 for fermions. So a species which decoupled at energies above 100 GeV, like energies that are not explored by particle accelerators, would contribute an ineffective, which is around 0.027 times the G star of the relic. If the error bar on ineffective could be pushed down to a value lower than this, lower than around 0.027, then it would be a really powerful probe of light relics at energies above the energy scales of the standard model. That would require improving the current error bar by like an order of magnitude or so, but that may be possible with experiments in the next 10 years or so. Let me also just briefly comment that in extensions of the standard model, this continues to go up. This will go up again at some point, like in supersymmetric extensions of the standard model. There's like a supersymmetry breaking scale at say 10 TeV or so, where G star might go up by another factor of a few. Put a question mark there. So that was a bit of a tangent, but I just wanted to explain exactly what we know observationally about the hot component, what we might hope to learn, and that at the present time, all of our constraints on the hot component are consistent with standard model neutrinos and no other light relics. But we may see something new if we improve the error bar by a factor of 10 or so. Moving on next to the observational constraints on the cold component. So there are basically two constraints. One is that, of course, is that it's very large today. We know that the fraction of the current energy density in cold dark matter, which I'll write omega c for cold dark matter, is just for fun, I took the current current constraints because I thought it was sort of useful to see how small the error bars are. These numbers are all known to a few percent. And then just for comparison, I'll write down the rest of the cosmic energy density today. So the cold dark matter is about 27% of the universe today, or the stress energy today. And the so-called baryonic matter, which is what cosmologists call non-relativistic standard model particles. Not very good terminology because it includes the electrons, for example, which are not actually baryons. Famously, there's about 5 times as much cold dark matter today as there is baryonic or standard model matter. The cosmological constant is the dominant component today. These error bars are like a global analysis that I took them from one of the Planck CMB experiment papers. They're a global analysis that involves a bunch of cosmological data sets, but they're CMB dominated. The error bars would not be much larger if I had only used the CMB. And then the photons are completely dominated by the CMB. There's way more stress energy in CMB photons than there are starlight, say, or other wavelengths. And then finally, neutrinos, which are known to be where we just have an upper bound. In the first lecture, I had drawn this expansion history where the universe was radiation dominated at first, then matter dominated for a long time, and then recently became cosmological constant dominated. During the period of matter domination, the ratio between the cold dark matter and the baryonic matter is fixed at around 5 to 1. You know, right now we're just switching over to cosmological constant domination. And a few Hubble times, the cosmological constant will be much larger than the other components. Today, the stress energy in relativistic species is tiny. During radiation domination, the stress energy of photons and neutrinos dominates the universe. And are comparable. The photons turn out to be about 60%, and the neutrinos turn out to be about 40%. That's something that we'd have the machinery to show. Just to be a little bit more precise about exactly what components are dominating when. So these constraints come mostly from the CMB, and that's how we know that there's more cold dark matter today than there is baryonic matter. If you were to remove the cold dark matter from the early universe or replace it by baryonic matter, you would really get the wrong CMB power spectrum. You can see that the error bar here is excluding zero at something like 50 sigma. Okay. And then the other thing that's known about the cold component is that it's cold, which I didn't really define yet. One way of saying it is that it has small velocity dispersion. If I compute an expectation like this, if I have a model for the cold dark matter that predicts its occupation numbers FQ and how momenta are distributed, then I can calculate an expectation value like this to get a typical velocity or an RMS velocity. This is known. So if I assume that that velocity scales as 1 over a, then the observational bound is something like this. This bound doesn't come from the CMB, but it comes from the amount, from the abundance of small scale structures in the universe. Things like the abundance of small groups of galaxies, collapsed gravitational structures on small scales, are where this constraint comes from. You know, qualitatively, the way it works is that I'll just kind of draw a cartoon of where this comes from. If I imagine that I have a bunch of dark matter particles that are collapsing into gravitationally collapsing into a small scale structure. Here's my cartoon of their world lines. Um, If the this is kind of an organized process where all of the particles start out at rest in the FRW rest frame. But now if I give them a velocity dispersion, like if I scramble the velocities of the particles randomly, then this won't happen. They'll just sort of end up all over the place, and you won't have this organized collapse. The thing that I think is really surprising about this constraint is that the this is in units of C, is that the bound is so small. 4 times 10 to the minus 7 C is around 100 meters per second. It's a tiny velocity compared to other astrophysical velocities. Like the Earth's orbit around the sun is around 10 to the minus 4 C, or like the rotation speed of the Milky Way is more like 10 to the minus 3 C. The point is that if I assume that it goes like 1 over A, then the velocities are not tiny in the early universe. Like, could the CM be epic? And that's where these gravitationally bound structures start to form. They're very fragile at first, so that a little bit of velocity dispersion can make a big difference. So it turns out if you put in a small amount of velocity dispersion, you suppress the early formation of small structures. And then when you run the rest of the cosmological history from the CMB until today, it has some measurable impact on the abundance of small-scale structure. So starting from these observational constraints, I want to sort of motivate a thermal relic model for cold dark matter. So first question you might ask is whether the cold dark matter could be a fourth neutrino species. The answer is no. It's impossible to match. It's not possible to match both constraints at the same time, the abundance constraint today and the coldness constraint today. As you showed in homework one, if I add a fourth neutrino species with some mass m nu, this is the omega that you would get. So you can read off that to get the observed abundance today, you would need the neutrino mass to be around 12 eV. A question that I could have asked in homework one but didn't was to calculate the velocity dispersion for a cosmic neutrino. I decided to put this in homework two. And you'll get this answer. Some Riemann zeta functions appear, which gives something like this today. And so you can see that you could only satisfy the velocity constraint if the coldness constraint, if the mass were larger than around a keV. So there's about two orders of magnitude separating these constraints. So just for fun, I decided to work out what would happen if instead of a neutrino, which freezes out at a specific temperature, I generalize to a to a hot relic. Which means that it's which just means any species which is relativistic at decoupling. So then all that happens is you get some factors of the G star at decoupling. I'm shortly going to try to explain the cold dark matter with a cold relic, that is, a particle which freezes out of the early universe at a time when it's non-relativistic. But to appreciate the problem with a hot relic, if I put in the factors of G star deck, like this, minus one third. I expected to find that this was like totally ruled out, the hot, thermal hot relic, and that you would need a thermal cold relic. But the answer seems to be that it's not actually ruled out. It's just kind of far-fetched. You need something like G star around 10 to the 3 and mass around 1 keV. That's a little far-fetched since the standard in the standard model G star deck can only go up to 106.75. But if at energies far above the standard model, G star went up to 1,000 or so, then it seems like as far as I know, a hot relic would not be ruled out by current data. But I may be missing a constraint that I didn't know about. I may not have the latest and greatest constraint on the velocity dispersion. Anyway, after that little tangent, I now want to show that a cold relic meaning that it freezes out at a temperature below the particle's rest mass. It sort of naturally fits the CDM constraints. I'm going to do this calculation in a little less detail than the Bauman notes. Meaning that I won't keep track of all the 2 pi's and so on, but the calculation will be significantly shorter. So I'll consider 2 parameters. Consider some new particle chi with mass m chi, and then a cross section which exchanges chi particles with the standard model. And then I'll make the approximation of instantaneous freeze out. At some temperature, TF. So I'll assume that the relic particle is in thermal equilibrium with the plasma until this temperature, and then free streaming after that. And this is where I differ from the Baumann calculation, where he integrates a differential equation rather than assuming thermal equilibrium. Okay, and I'll be dropping order one constants throughout. Okay, so this is a two-parameter model. The freeze-out temperature will be determined by the cross-section of the particle mass. And the goal is to calculate two quantities, the abundance today, omega c, and the velocity dispersion. So the first thing that I'll compute is the freeze-out temperature. So this is a lot like the neutrino case, so I'll gloss over some details. I'll assume that the particle freezes out when the interaction rate, number of interactions per chi particle per time, is of order the Hubble expansion rate, where the interaction rate is, as in the neutrino case, is the cross-section times the number density of particles multiplied by their characteristic velocity. For the number density of particles, here's where the calculation starts to differ from the neutrino case, which was a hot relic. There, for the number density, I took a relativistic limit. Here, I'll take a non-relativistic limit, which, after dropping order one constants, if you refer back to an equation that we wrote down a few lectures ago, looks like this. And then for the velocity, so this is not something that I calculated before, but for a non-relativistic species in thermal equilibrium, the velocity is of order T over M to the 1/2, or the velocity dispersion. You can calculate that because we wrote down the occupation number FQ by doing some integrals. Or a shortcut way to see it is to say that in thermal equilibrium, the particle's kinetic energy should be of order the temperature, which rearranging leads to V of order square root T over M. And then in the next line, I'll just simplify and write it this way. The Hubble expansion rate goes exactly like the neutrino case. By Friedman's equation, H squared is the energy density over 3m Planck. And Planck squared. And then for the total energy density, I'll just write that as T to the 4th to the 1/2. More accurately, the total energy density of the plasma will be, you know, some G star times an order one constant times T to the 4th, where G star is of order one. This is T squared n. Okay, so then to determine the freeze-out temperature, I'll set gamma over H to 1. Shall I write this way? Um,
I'll put TF here for freeze up.
Taking the log on both sides and rearranging, I'll write the result as m over x, where it's conventional in papers on thermal relic dark matter to define the quantity x as the log of this quantity, sigma times the particle mass times the Planck mass. So for this calculation to be self-consistent, x has to be much larger than one, since I was assuming that the freeze-out temperature was much less than the particle's rest mass. X can't be too large, since it's the log of something. For example, if the particle mass is of order TeV, and sigma is of order, is an electroweak cross section, then x is around 30. And I'll use this as like a baseline value. Then the next thing I'll do is I'll compute the relic density today. So I'll start with the physical density at freeze-out. So then I'll write that at Twiddle level like this. This is just like an earlier step where I wrote down n for a non-relativistic particle by referring back to a previous result. This is the previous result that we had written down before for the energy density of a thermal species. When it's non-relativistic, it's just one factor of the rest mass times the result that we wrote down for the number density, and then this can be rearranged. This can be rewritten in terms of x. It should look like this. It's maybe not the best notation, but I'll just write down what I mean. The subscript F means the energy density at freeze-out. And then we use something like rho C0 to be the energy density today. A not very helpful way to write that is rho f times AF, the scale factor at freeze out cubed. Since for non-relativistic particles, the energy density always goes as a to the minus 3, and a is 1 today. To write that in a more helpful fashion, I'll relate the ratio of scale factors to the ratio of temperatures. This is true because CMB temperature, or the plasma temperature, is always going as 1 over A. To within order one factors. Like there's a for neutrinos, there's a factor of 4/11 to the 1/3 here. For a general relic, that will be some different order one number. If there's T gamma. So then I have a useful formula for the energy density today, ignoring order one constants and in terms of the CMB temperature. Finally, to compare to the observational constraint, I just need to divide this by the total energy density today. I'll write that this way. The total energy density today is written this way. So then, looking up the values for the CMB temperature and the observed Hubble expansion rate today, and converting all the units, after plugging in the numbers, you end up with this. So, to produce the observed cold matter abundance, you need something like a cross section of order 10 to the minus 7 GeV to the minus 2, with weak dependence on the mass. Or logarithmic dependence. M matters a little bit because it goes into the definition of X, but with a log. If I change M by an order one amount, it only changes X by a few percent. So this is sometimes called the WIMP miracle. The statement that the electro weak scale an electro weak cross section naturally appears. I haven't computed the velocity dispersion yet. I'll do that in a moment and show that it satisfies the velocity dispersion constraint is satisfied. The WIMP stands for weakly interacting massive particle. So a really natural model for where cold dark matter may have come from is that if there's some beyond the standard model particle, perhaps a super partner of a standard model particle, with a cross-section around the electro-weak scale, then it would naturally freeze out in the early universe and form the cold dark matter today. If you have a really, so far we haven't really placed constraints on the mass. But if you, I will comment that if you have a really specific model for the cold dark matter particle, like if it couples to the, if it's like the Higgs-Eno or something, and it couples to the standard model in some in a really specific way, then by because the energy density, because the cold dark matter density is known so precisely to a few percent, then the logarithmic dependence is good enough, and you can predict the mass from the cosmological abundance. So this has given some a few natural targets, like things like the Higgs-Eno, the Wino, and so on, in the sigma M plane, to look for with dark matter detection experiments. Unfortunately, the direct detection experiments haven't seen anything yet, and many of those natural candidates have been ruled out. But a few of them survive, like the Higgs-Eno, for example, where the mass, the inferred mass, is around 1 TeV from the cosmological abundance, is still allowed. And I think that one will be very difficult to test with dark matter, with direct dark matter detection experiments. Okay. There's one more thing I want to calculate, which is the velocity dispersion. Maybe I'll leave this board up. Actually, I think it's better to erase this one. So, the last thing I want to calculate is the velocity dispersion. I decided to put this on homework too. I'll just write down what you get. Plugging in numbers, I assume that x is around 30 and the temperature of the cold dark matter is around the cosmic neutrino temperature. Then the observational constraint is really easy to satisfy. As long as the mass is greater than a few keV. In addition to this sort of hard lower limit on the CDM mass, I think there's also a pretty convincing argument, which I'll just say in words. There's also pretty convincing argument. That the mass has to be greater than 1 MeV for a cold thermal relic. And The argument goes as follows. If you make the mass lower than this, then dark matter freeze-out occurs after neutrino freeze-out, and this will mess up the cosmic neutrino background temperature. So our calculation of the cosmic neutrino background temperature, 4/11 to the 1/3 times the CMB temperature, assumed that the only annihilation event between neutrino freeze-out and today was the electron-positron annihilation. If there's another annihilation event from cold dark matter, then that would break that calculation. It's not too hard to see that what happens is the cosmic neutrino background becomes colder. So the temperature is less than 2 Kelvin today, and the value of N effective is decreased. The current constraint on N effective from the CMB is so good that even if the cold dark matter is a scalar, if it just has one spin degree of freedom, that makes N effective come out too low by something like 3 sigma. The reason why I say that this is pretty convincing and not airtight is that that argument does have the following loophole. If a dark matter, a cold relic less than an MeV, has the property that N effective is sort of 3 sigma low, well, you could fix that by putting in an unrelated hot relic that makes a positive contribution to N effective. Earlier, I had written down, I think it's still on the board somewhere in the upper board, if I have some unrelated hot relic that decouples at some large value of G star, then I just give it enough spin degrees of freedom to bring N effective back up to the standard model value, and I can cancel out this problem. That's a logically consistent scenario, but it seems a bit far-fetched. I think I'm ending exactly on time. One comment I want to make, I think that this is all that I'll say about dark matter is this cold relic, thermal relic model for where the cold dark matter came from. But there are other models as well. There are models where the dark matter has something to do with axions, or there are models where the dark matter freezes in instead of freezing out, that the cross-section is small when the plasma temperature is high and then becomes large so that it's out of equilibrium at early times but comes into thermal equilibrium at late times. A few different scenarios. I think that Jenwu was talking about some of these scenarios in more detail in the particle physics class that runs in parallel with this one. In this class, I'll just leave it at that. In the next lecture, I'll move on to inflation and the very early universe. Does anyone have a question before we end for today? Yes.
In step one, we said that gamma over H is around 1.
Yes.
Is it an assumption or some observation result?
Oh yeah, why is that? So the particle interaction freezes out if the interaction rate becomes small. But the question is small compared to what? The interaction rate is like the number of interactions per unit time that a single particle experiences. The only thing to really compare that to is the Hubble time, or the amount of time it takes for the scale factor to increase by some order one amount. If gamma over H is much larger than 1, then a dark matter particle will experience many interactions per Hubble time and stay in thermal equilibrium as the universe expands. If it's much less than 1, then there are few interactions for each doubling of the universe's size. The particle quickly loses thermal contact with the plasma. In fact, for sort of realistic temperature dependence, once gamma over H drops below 1, you could show that a particle will typically experience much less than one interactions for the rest of the history of the universe. At least that's what happens for neutrinos. That criterion is the same as it was in our analysis of the cosmic neutrino background. The only things that are really different in this calculation are some steps where we took a non-relativistic limit instead of a relativistic limit. The expression for n in brackets in step one, and the expression for rho at the beginning of step two. Yes?
For this equation, why is rho total 0 equals h 0 squared over 3 m log squared? Because h squared is rho over 3 m log squared. So
oh, yes, thank you. Oh, yeah. Thanks. Okay. Thanks, everyone, and I'll see you tomorrow at 11:30.